It's Ian Pickus. We are back in the Congressional Corner today with first-term Congressman George Latimer, a Democrat from New York's 16th District. And Congressman Latimer, it's been a busy few weeks since we last talked. Welcome back.
Nice to be with you again, Ian.
To begin with, do you have any memories of the late Charlie Rangel?
Charles Rangel was such an iconic figure. By the time I started to be involved in the state level of government, he was already established as a bedrock. But so many people that I've dealt with and got to know, Keith Wright in the New York State Assembly and others, David Patterson, they all spoke of what a role model he was to them in their early years. And so through the work that he himself did and the work that the people that he has inspired has done has really given him a legitimate legacy. And that doesn't happen for most of us in government, but it does for Charles Rangel.
So let's talk about some current business in Congress. This is our first time talking since the so-called Big Beautiful Bill passed the House by just one vote. And of course, you and the other Democrats were no votes. So what were your objections specifically?
Well, it's a big, ugly bill, to be honest with you. And as you know from covering Albany, they always call the big ugly the last bill of session where they put
That's
a lot
true.
Of different things in. And in many ways, this is the ideological soup for which all of the MAGA policies are being thrown into it. The headline negatives, the dramatic cuts to Medicaid are horrific. And it's not just because it's going to hurt people that need medical assistance. It's going to hurt our hospitals. And we heard that from hospital organizations, Greater New York Hospital and Haney's and so forth. It's going to hurt nursing homes. And we heard that from the nursing homes industry. The cutting out of the revenue stream of Medicaid as they plan to do it is going to be devastating. The reduction to SNAP in the food programs. We have issues with food insecurity already in this state, in my area of the state. And this is only going to exacerbate it and make it worse. They cut a host of different tax incentives for renewable energy. We're trying our best to move from fossil fuels into a renewable world. It's going to take time. It's not going to happen overnight. But to cut back on these tax credits makes us go backwards into the drill, baby, drill policies that the Republican Party have advanced. Remember, they chanted that at one of the national conventions a number of years ago. And then there are a host of other things, taking away from the state the power to regulate AI and let it be a Washington decision. Well, Washington makes decisions in the most convoluted of political ways. I'd rather let New York make decisions that make sense in New York than to usurp that power. I'm not sure any of these things are legal. There's a provision in the bill that basically says that the lower courts don't have any jurisdiction mm-hmm. over presidential decisions. Well, that's patently unconstitutional. And so on issue after issue, there's objectionable things in this bill. And the fact that it passed by one vote, strictly partisan, tells you that. There was no effort to try to work across the aisle, no effort to try to find common ground. And as you know, you've covered me during my tenure as Westchester County Executive. We worked very hard to have common ground in Westchester, and many times we got that bipartisan support. But in Washington, you know, right now there's unified control, and President Trump wants to dictate the terms, and that's what this bill is. It's his bill, his big, beautiful vision for America, which I think is a bad vision for America.
Now, in your history as an elected official, you've worked in local government and you've been in the executive. And I wonder what you make of the fact that the CBO says that the tax part of this big package will add $2.4 trillion to the deficit, which, I mean, often is something Republicans run against.
Well, in fact, they had some heavy duty arm twisting to get the Freedom Caucus to go along with this big, beautiful bill, because it does, I think it's in round numbers, $3 trillion increase to our deficit. Now, it depends on how you're going to use money to determine whether or not it's wise or unwise to borrow money. As a county government official, we borrowed money to make capital improvements, things that might take us 10 or 20 years to pay back, but would have a 30-year lifespan. The basic reason why we're both cutting services and increasing the debt limit is to satisfy a tax cut that was given in 2017 that they want to maintain in perpetuity. And that tax cut goes to the wealthiest of taxpayers. It already exists for some of the major corporations. And you're taking, I mean, this is reverse Robin Hood. You're taking away from people of modest means, and you're doing it so that people who are already wealthy, you know, quote unquote, don't need it, they may want it, but to make sure that they have a continued deep tax cut. And it's bad public policy. And all of these things are going to come back to haunt us. We'll see how this story ends. But if in the basic direction, what we're going to do is make more people hungry and more people sick, that is not a strategy for success in this country.
Now, from what I've been reading, the Senate is not so keen on the salt cap compromise that was reached by some in the House Republican Conference as part of this bill. What's your view on where things ended up in the House?
Well, I'm not so keen on the compromise either. I want to lift the whole restriction and return to what we had for 100 years. You know, the salt tax deduction isn't a gift that was given in 1985 or 1995, and it's been around for 20 or 30 years. This is a 100-year deduction that goes back to the establishment of federal income tax. And the logic of it is inescapable. When you receive money and you have it as discretion, you pay taxes on that. But when that money goes to pay taxes for another level of government, either property taxes or income taxes, you don't have that money. But yet the federal government is now taxing me for money that I frankly don't have. It's being withheld to be given to the state and to the and to the municipal government. So it's an unfair double taxation. The reason why it was lifted in 2017 was A, because they needed the $1 trillion that it would generate to help offset the tax cuts that they had planned for the very wealthy. And then number two, because there are red states that have minimal local taxation, and they felt like, well, why are we, how come we can't get a benefit from that? But the blue states do. What they failed to realize is the blue states generate more revenue to the federal government than the red states do. Alaska is a net state that gains money from the feds. Mississippi, Alabama, they're net gainers. New York, Massachusetts, we generate more money for the federal government than we take back in benefits. And, so the resentment really should be on the blue state side. We're the ones with economic engines. And let me say this, you have taxation in New York and Connecticut and Massachusetts and New Jersey, but you also have more thorough services. The person in one of those red states, they're on their own to do a bunch of things, or they don't do them at all. And, you have to figure out how to do things in your state, which we in New York believe is part of a baseline of a proper society. And New York has led the way, and states like Massachusetts alongside of us, Connecticut and others, in showing that government can solve and address problems. And yes, they use tax dollars to do it. So you have the flexibility of moving. If you don't like New York, move to Texas. If you don't like Texas, move to New York. But this is an attempt to take Texas policy and impose it on New York and Connecticut and Massachusetts. And that is just not tenable. One more point, Ian. I know I'm going long.
No,
on this.
Please.
The victory by Donald Trump was not a mandate. He won by a percentage point and a half to 2 percentage points. That's a smaller margin than Biden beat him in 2020. It's actually a smaller margin than Hillary Clinton outpolled him in 2016. He has no mandate. He won. He won, legitimately won by a little bit. But there's a host of examples out there since the election where he's lost steam. So I don't think he represents at all the majority of the American thinking on these things.
So, Congressman Latimer, we were talking about the quote-unquote big, beautiful bill that's now over in the Senate, and the Senate is facing what has been imposed as a July 4th deadline. We'll see if they get there. Are you expecting the contours of this to be changed significantly in the other chamber?
It's hard to know at this point, Ian. I'm seeing a pattern that was seen in the House when the House debated the bill, which is members of the House majority objecting to parts of the bill and saying that they couldn't accept it. And then after the president worked his magic, they fell in line on both the far right part of the Republican Party and those that represent the more moderate portion of the Republican Party. Let us talk politics for a second. Donald Trump, for all the things he is wildly popular with the Republican base. There are people who support him in almost a cult-like attachment. They believe in him and whatever he does, whatever he says. And the Republican elected officials know this. And they fear that if Donald Trump says, I'm coming after you in the next primary, and if Elon Musk is there with the money, although Musk has been critical of this bill, if Musk puts some money behind that oomph, and Trump certainly has access to money as well, then they can lose their seats to a more MAGA Republican. I've heard, in the New Jersey governor primary, one of the candidates proclaims how he's the most MAGA of the candidates in the race. They want that attachment for the Republican primary. So if he is that powerful, when he starts putting the hammer down, some of the guys who right now are objecting to things may fall in line. It happened in the House. It could happen in the Senate. And if it does, then there won't be very many major changes. There'll be a few. And the Senate does have a little different set of rules and style, where individuals do have more juice than they do in the House. But I don't expect major changes, because I think Donald Trump wants this as his signature governing document to take him through this term.
You know, I experienced it as something of a fever dream, but now that Musk is out, his short-term stay in the federal government is over. What do you make of his imprint on the way that this term is playing out? I mean, he clearly had a lot of influence, and whether that's changed is, I think, still being worked out.
Yeah, I don't think it's past tense. He may not be there in Washington. He's going to devote time to his businesses. But I think he still looms because of his wealth and his ability to have a platform like X under his control. Look, I think Mr. Musk is very good at what he is good at, but I've said this about myself many, many times. I know what I know, and I know what I don't know. And the things that I don't know, I don't try to BS my way through. I try to find people to be around me who can complement and bring skills that I don't have. I think Elon Musk believes that he's good at everything because he's good at some very specific things. And in the world of public policy, I think he took no understanding whatsoever of what it is to deal with a diverse population and services to them. I made a speech on the floor criticizing his comments that he made at the Joe Rogan podcast that empathy is the greatest weakness of Western civilization. And I posited that empathy is the bedrock of Western civilization, and I went on to make my case. But so I don't think his influence is gone. And what I do think is that there is a certain mindset of people in this country, and it's not an insignificant number. They're angry. They don't trust government. They don't like government. They see the foibles of government. Every government has things, decisions we've made that were poorly made. That you assert that there's waste. There's no doubt waste in everything, but there's waste in the private sector too. And there's waste in every entity you can think of. And I see it when I go into, a place to get a cup of coffee and a donut. I see some wasted time and energy and effort going on there too. But to assert it's fraud and corruption without proving it is irresponsible. And that's what they've done. And there's a cacophony of voices that clap, just automatically. So I think his influence is still there. And I think that the threat of Musk using his resources is still there. So I don't think he's gone at all. I think his influence in the government has been negative because he never took time to apply any objective standard to the things he did. He pulled out that symbolic chainsaw. He went after departments, asserted that they were bad, asserted USAID is bad. And there are people right now starving in the Sudan. There are people in sub-Saharan Africa that are suffering from Ebola that are going to die because we got rid of USAID in its entirety to satisfy an ideology.
Let me change gears and ask you about some of your successes here in the early going of the term. The last time we were talking about this Transparency and Predictability in Small Business Opportunities Act of yours, and since then, it's passed unanimously. So A, congrats, and B, remind us, what does it do?
Well, the bill is very targeted, and what it does is it requires the federal government through the Small Business Administration to come up with rules to work with those small businesses that apply for a government program to provide a service or a product to the government when they respond to a bid. And I've been on the other side of that in my Westchester County experiences, where you put together a bid and you offer it out, and if the small business comes in and can bid successfully, they get the contract. The problem is that it can take a lot of time and money to put together one of these bids. And whatever the complication was in the county or even the state, federal government is infinitely more complicated. It's been estimated you could spend $10,000 just to put the bid together, whether you get the contract or not. And so what these rules do is sort of err the side of the person that's making the application, giving them greater transparency so they can assess the risk of spending that much money. And then if it turns out that they're not successful when the government decides to cancel a contract, that the government has some obligation to work with those companies to see if there are alternate contracts that are available that they could adjust to and, you know, save some of the money that they've laid out in producing the bid. The rules that have to be created come out of the legislation, so the legislation does not have the rules embedded in it, which is probably well, because you might want to have the flexibility to change the rules. But it's a common sense bill. I compliment Congressman Mark Alford of Missouri, Congressman Kwame Nfumi from Maryland, Maggie Goodlander from New Hampshire. These were all critical people that made it happen as well. And while I take credit as the sponsor of the bill, it was a community effort and an example of how you can work together if you want to work together. In this particular case, we worked together because the majority wanted to do that, and we have a good product to show.
Do you think President Trump is inclined to sign it?
Well, we'll see if it gets through the Senate first. Mm-hmm. This is where, you know, I turned to one of my staff people who joined me, has experience working on the Senate side. So I turned to him and said, okay, explain to me how we get this through the Senate because of the filibuster provisions and individual senatorial privilege, which we don't have an equivalent of in the House. But we'll see how it works. I was, as a state senator back in the teens, in the minority, and I still managed to pass in my freshman year, 6 bills. Now, they would tend to be local bills, but the relationships I developed across the aisle, I was a marginal, so they wanted my seat in the next election, but they weren't averse to passing bills if there was merit to it. So I'm hopeful that'll be the same case this time.
So you've announced your community project funding projects for the year, AKA some earmarks. What are the highlights on your list?
Well, the first most important thing is we made a decision early on when the House had their continuing resolution, this majority did not reauthorize those projects that had been submitted and approved last year under my predecessor. And the communities had every reason to think that these bills had passed, and they had their moments with the big check and all of that. And that moment belonged to my predecessor. And while we disagreed in a primary, what he did that was legitimate should have been granted. Well, they didn't. So now what I've done, our team has done, is we've resubmitted, you know, mostly all of the same projects because they're necessary projects. And they range across the board. In the city of Mount Vernon, a significant amount of money to restore their armory, which served as a senior center in one section of town. Very important project to complete. The stormwater management in Hastings on Hudson. There's drainage improvements in City Park, one of the major facilities in New Rochelle. There's a sidewalk improvement on a major artery in Tarrytown. There's work in Depot Square in Tuckahoe. Warburton Avenue has steep slopes that lead down to the Metro North Hudson line where improvement has to be made. And there's 15 of these. So we've resubmitted them. We met with each of the different municipal governments. I have a strong municipal government connection from everything I've done in the past. Jessica Merritt, our legislative director, came up and looked at them and helped craft it. And we're hopeful that this time through, these projects will not just be approved at the legislative level, but actually be authorized, and then these communities will have the money to start moving forward on it. There can always be a slip between cup and lip, but we've done the right thing by resubmitting these so as not to let the expectations from a year ago disappear.
We've been speaking today with New York Congressman George Latimer, a Democrat from the 16th District. He's in his first term in Congress, and we're very grateful for your time. And when we come back, let's talk some more.
Happy to do it, Ian.
Congressman Latimer, I want to talk some politics with you. I've been talking with some of your colleagues who say that the Republican package, the quote, big, beautiful bill, is unpopular, and so is the president, and they have circled the 2026 midterms. So first of all, do you feel like your party will be in better shape by the next election than it was in the last election?
I think the referendum in 26 will be on the policies of this president, which have been approved almost as a rubber stamp by this House majority and the Senate majority. In 24, there were different issues on the table, and there was a different perception of things. Now, you know, that victory in 24 gave the Republicans unified control of the government. They want to keep talking about what happened in 22 and 23, go ahead. But you have power now. What are you doing with power? If what you're doing with power is cutting Medicaid, is cutting SNAP, if what you're doing with power is relocating offices out of New York City to spite the city government, or to defund not-for-profits or to defund certain local governments and to require them to do things that are not in keeping with the policies of their area, that's going to be what you're going to vote on in 26. These tariffs are insane. They oscillate back and forth. We slap Canada in the face. The president says they should be the 51st state, and he says it three times. Travel up to Clinton County or Franklin County or St. Lawrence County with the economic interaction over the border between Quebec, Canada, and the United States, New York State, is tremendous. Go up there and tell those merchants that slapping Canada around is good for tourism, is good for business. Or go to Erie County, where you have a common border, a couple of areas with Ontario, and tell me that's a good policy. And it isn't. So that's the referendum in 26. Now, if Republicans showed more independence from the president, if some of them said, I disagree with this or that. As a Democrat, I disagreed with Joe Biden on the border. I made my comments as a county executive because I had to deal with the implementation of it. I thought Joe Biden was a good president, but I also criticized and where I thought there was criticism was deserved. But the Republicans aren't doing that. They're so afraid of Donald Trump that they won't say anything negative. So they're going to own it. They're going to own it, you know, from top to bottom. Now, what will happen in 26? We're still a year away from the primaries of 26, much less the generals a year and a half away. Anything can happen. It's almost like 100 years between now and when the electorate makes the decision in 26. But at this moment, the victory of November, six plus months ago, is not the climate of today. And the climate of today is, what are you doing with these tariffs? Are you messing with my Social Security? You close this office. You're messing with my veterans benefits. You're taking a free plane from a Middle Eastern country, Qatar, that's negotiating with Hamas. You got a lot of explaining to do. You got to explain a lot here.
I bet you would enjoy being in the House majority for a change. So do you plan to run for re-election?
Well, I haven't made the final decision on it, but yes. I mean, when you're a freshman, particularly in the minority, you know, our ability to accomplish much is very limited. And I think I've proven over an extended period of time, 13 years in the state legislature, 13 years in the county legislature, four of which I was the chairman, first Democrat to chair a county executive years and so forth. Plus my business background, 20-year career in business that overlapped the beginning of my public career, that when given an opportunity to make a contribution, that I can make a contribution. My ability to do so in the minority as a freshman is pretty minimal, even though I got a bill passed and, you know, we're trying to influence some things. So it's logical for me to want to have that. But the decision on what to do really has to be left until the end of this year's election is completed, the 25 cycle. My focus from the world of politics is on the folks who are running right now. Ken Jenkins, my successor running for re-election as county executive, members of the county board of legislators, supervisors, and elected officials in Westchester and in the Bronx. I've endorsed Kevin Riley and councilman and Vanessa Gibson, the borough president, for re-election. They're friends. They're good people. That's my focus between now and November. Do a good job here. And then, you know, right after that, we'll make a decision and we'll be public about it.
I'm glad you mentioned the Bronx. You do have a sliver of it in your district, and they're about to have a mayoral primary this month. It looks like Andrew Cuomo's to lose. Do you agree with that conventional wisdom?
Well, the polls seem to be pretty decisive. And not only, you know, the general, the beauty contest of the poll, it looks to be at least double his nearest competitor. But when you go through the ranked choice, which, you know, I haven't voted or run under a ranked choice system. That's a New York City system. But they go through the mechanics of how many people are going to pick somebody to be number five, number four, number three. Even when they go through that process, he still winds up looking like a solid victor. So I do expect him to win. I know most of the other candidates in the race, not all of them, but I know most of them. I've served with Scott Stringer in the state assembly. He is a very fine guy, would make a good mayor. I have great respect for Zelmer Myrie and for Michael Blake and a number of these other folks. But, you know, there is a political reality to things, and I've faced it a number of times. I've taken on some tough races in my life, and I've won, but it's no walk in the park. But, you know, in a multi-candidate field, when you have one candidate who's got universal name recognition, has more money, is a strong person, there's no question, and whatever the overall assessment of Andrew Cuomo's governorship is, he accomplished things. You know, he built a bridge over the Hudson that nobody said could be done. Fixed LaGuardia Airport, nobody said could be done. He was the driving force behind marriage equality. I voted for it, but he was the one that got it over the finish line. And gun control, the SAFE Act. And that's not popular everywhere in the state, but certainly in New York City it is. and raise the minimum wage. So there's a real record of achievement that he's running on, aside from, you know, the things that are problematic. So I do expect him to win, but we'll see what happens. The voters always get the last word.
And do you think you'll have a decent relationship with him if he becomes mayor?
Well, I would expect so. I mean, you know, he served in Washington already. He was 30 years ago. He
was secretary.
The secretary of HUD. So he knows how Washington works. Obviously, this is a different administration, and he's going to want his relationships with the Republican members of our delegation. But I would expect, as I have been so far, to be, you know, an energetic member. And we have a strong delegation. Jerry Nadler, Greg Meeks, Grace Meng, Richie Torres, Nydia Velasquez, she's terrific. There's so many wonderful people in the New York City delegation. I'm happy to be, you know, a person that works with them, behind them. I don't have to lead. I mean, I'm more of a leader from the Westchester portion of my district. But in New York City, I think if the mayor's initiatives are sound and solid, I think he's going to have full support from the delegation.
So what's your take on Lieutenant Governor Delgado's now official primary challenge against Governor Hochul?
Well, you know, I think the governor is in a strong position to get renominated. I haven't made any official endorsements yet. The announcement by the lieutenant governor just came a couple of days ago. In fact, I was down here when the announcement came. Well, he's going to make the formal announcement in Schenectady and all that, I guess. But, you know, there's nothing that happens on a statewide basis that doesn't involve a primary. And I created a primary myself for this congressional seat. So, you know, who am I to say that, you know, primaries are intrinsically wrong? But I do think that there's going to be a dialogue amongst Democrats about what direction to go in. And I think the governor's going to have a strong case to make that she's fought hard and to try to do things. Lieutenant Governor's an impressive person. I like him. I was supportive of him in his lieutenant governor race. He had a good record in Congress. So I expect, you know, I expect both of them to compete. I don't know if that's all that's going to get into the race. You never know. There could be others. It's too soon for me to, you know, opine officially. I'll find the time and place to do that. But I will tell you that as I experienced from my primaries, I had a primary 8 years ago with Ken Jenkins to become county executive. And that was a tough primary. I was a state senator and he was a county legislator who had been board chairman. But we managed to have a primary with mutual respect, so much so that by the time the primary ended, I was the winner of the primary. He endorsed me. I won the election. I asked him to be my number two. He served tremendously as a leader in his own right. And now he is the county executive leading in his own right. So a primary does not have to be a demolition derby. It depends on the people involved and how much they prioritize the end result, because we have rumors that Elise Stefanik now is going to get in the race on the governor's side, on the Republican side. And, you know, she's a formidable candidate, but she's flat out MAGA. And if you want to have a governor who can, in their budget presentation, cut out a woman's right to choose or end gay marriage, you could do that if you're the governor and you write that into the budget. You think twice about who you want to have sitting in that chair. Mike Lawler, who's a colleague of mine down here, I know him very well over the years. He may make that race. There's a lot of things that are imponderable. It's going to give you a lot to write about, Ian. You're not going to lack for news.
No, we never do. And I'll just say, you know, with Lawler and Stefanik, one thing they don't have in common with you is they haven't taken up our open invitation to come back on the Congressional Corner, and they are welcome to at any time. But in the meantime, we are very grateful that you do so. Congressman George Latimer from New York's 16th District, thanks for spending all this time with us again.
A real pleasure, Ian, and look forward to seeing you next time I'm up in Albany.